Good afternoon, Prescott, and welcome to another edition of KYCA PM. It is an honor and a privilege to have with us today Hallie Efron, who is a best-selling author, and she has a new book out that is called Come and Find Me. It's a novel of suspense. And before we do anything else, I want you to go to Hallie's website if you're sitting in front of the computer and the radio. And her website is Hallie, H-A-L-L-I-E, Efron, EPHRON.com. And you'll be able to see not just her two solo books, but other books that she's written in conjunction with a co-author, and then also her nonfiction. So without any further ado, Hallie, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm really good. How are you?
I'm over my strep throat, so I'm doing just great. I'm real sorry I missed that call last week. I'm sorry I didn't get a hold of you to let you know on that. I'm just happy that you would come on and let us talk to you about your new book.
Well, as someone who's had strep throat, my condolences. It's especially as an adult, it's ignominious to get it.
No, it's one of those little things you got to bounce back from. Now, I got to tell you that I spend my other career as a teacher, I teach online, and I have six courses a semester and about 250 to 300 students a semester. And this novel really hit home with me in terms of how well you capture the isolation and the strangeness of being someone who cocoons themselves in through the internet. What led you to this subject matter, and how did you decide to set up this story of Diana?
How interesting. You're seeing students that have that? I'm just curious before I answer your question.
I see students who are very much like this. The heroine of this story reminds me of a lot of my students in a lot of ways.
Oh, no kidding. Actually, the idea came to me when I, believe it or not, first of all, I've had a lot of career on the internet. I worked for high-tech companies for years. As a writer, of course, that's your lifeline. I mean, there you are in your little box of an office in your home, and you're writing away, and through social media and the internet, you connect with people. Otherwise, you'd be completely on your own. But the thing that kind of triggered my interest was I saw this ad at Costco for $999, you could buy a year's supply of freeze-dried food. There was this beautiful display of pastel-colored cans arranged in a pyramid, and I thought, oh, my God, who would buy this, and for whom would it be, as the advertisement said, quote-unquote, buying peace of mind? And that's when the idea of Diana came to me, the character who is housebound because she's been traumatized by the outside world, and she lives on the internet, which, of course, we can do now. It's you can have a business. You can shop for clothing. You can get your food. You can find your friends. It's really another world.
It really is. And you really, I think part of this novel that is so appealing and so well written is when you describe her life online, living through the avatars. I think that's some of the best writing in the novel, and I think it's also the most frightening part of the novel, because you see someone who, in a classic psychological sense, is slipping away from concrete reality into this other world, the other world of the net, and it's almost frightening, and I think it's so well done that it really, I hope that was the effect you were going for, because it really does frighten you when you get into the book.
Well, I'm glad, because I think people make the mistake of thinking that it's a safe place, you know, that it's a place where you are protected. And in fact, you know, I mean, I'm one of these people who look at that little pinhole in the top of the frame of my computer screen, and I think, you know, is someone looking back at me? And every time you open the phone, somebody could theoretically grab your GPS coordinates and know exactly where you are. You know, what the internet has made us more vulnerable, even though it feels as if we're cocooning, as you said, you know, creating this private world and protecting ourselves. And it's kind of that dichotomy that I wanted to get at.
Well, Diana is a great way to do it, and she's an interesting character, and she gets fleshed out really, really well, and it's a very interesting treatment of her situation. tell our listeners a little bit of Diana's story and share with our listeners a little bit of her history.
Well, I knew I wanted a character who would be afraid to leave the house. She'd be agoraphobic. And so one of the things I did was talk to different people and psychologists about agoraphobia. You know, what is it something, is it, you know, that old thing where you get conked in the head and you lose your memory? Well, I knew that never really happens because I used to write with a psychologist and I thought, well, maybe it's true in agoraphobia too, that a single incident can't make you agoraphobic. And that is the case. You it's something that you probably, if you become agoraphobic, you've been fighting it all your life. It's all, not genetic, but family oriented. You know, it's not a one-time thing that causes you to be that way. So in creating Diana, I had to give her a backstory. That's what authors call, you know, the author, the background of the character that would explain why, when her lover and best friend falls in a climbing accident in the Alps when she's there, why that causes her to crawl into her shell and shore up her boundaries. And, you know, it's because she's always had that edge to her. She's always had that vulnerability ever since she was a little girl. So that's kind of her backstory. She was a hacker. They had gone ice climbing to celebrate going legit, and her lover died. And so she's trying to make a living still as a, not as a hacker now, but as a computer security expert in the best way she can, which is in her own house on the internet.
And she's just to the point, she and her, there was a trio of folks, her lover slash husband being one of them, and then the friend, that trio were hackers, and now the duo is left to be computer security experts, and they're just about to go big time. She's right on the precipice of making it when things start to go desperately wrong in her life. And that's kind of the fulcrum for the story. That's really where the story takes off, is at the point that it's almost to get, you know, the business angle is almost to explode and take off. And then suddenly you throw the wrench in.
Right. And then her personal life goes kaflooey when her sister disappears. And her sister's her only link, really, still. Her only piece of normal human interaction. And when her sister goes to an event that she kind of suggests she go to and disappears, it really throws her. And fortunately, it throws her back out into the real world.
Now, you write with great insight into the relationship of the two sisters. Is that because you're the mother of two daughters?
It is. It is. Did you notice the dedication in the book?
Well, I was going to say the dedication is for Molly and Naomi, little girls who grew up to be friends.
Yes,
and I got the direct impression that you took some of that tension between the two and based it on, it was just too good to be entirely fictional.
Yeah. Now, I really love the relationship that my daughters have. They're somewhat competitive and, you know, to use the very antiquated phrase, bosom buddies. And I love that about them, that they have that kind of friction. I mean, if they sit in the back, they're 30 and 35, and they will still fight in the back seat. It's hilarious. You know, they still have that puppiness about them that I just think is great. So I was trying to give Diana and Ashley, her sister, that kind of competitiveness, that their mother treats them differently and that they really are different and that they compete and yet they adore each other. And of course, I have three sisters of my own too, so I was also drawing, I think, less consciously on the competitiveness that is there whether you like it or not.
Now, you were, in reference to your sisters, your entire family is a writing family, and you were basically the last one who was forced into being a writer. And I relate to that very much. Everyone in my family except me is a lawyer. And I'm a huge screw up because I have a PhD and teach at a college. You know, that's I could be president of the United States and my dad would call and say, when are you going to give up all that political crap and go get your JD like a man?
Well, I can completely relate to that because in my family, it was all about words.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually have a real math aptitude. So I, along the way, ended up with a PhD virtually in educational statistics. And so I was always the one in the family who felt like I didn't quite fit.
Yeah, that's.
But I did eventually start writing. So.
But that prepares you to write for Diana, because there's a part of her that is about differentness. And, you know, a lot of the book really boils down to sameness and differentness, and whether or not are you part of this whole, or are you separate from the whole? And Diana's struggle with the, you know, the inside world, the outside world, with the cyber world and the real world is part of that whole separation that you feel when everybody else is doing this. And you're like, no, that I'm not going there.
Yeah. Now, and then eventually, of course, she turns it all upside down. But I don't want to give away the ending.
Well, and I'm very hesitant to talk too much more. I think we've laid down the predicate. I don't want to give anything away, because there's a couple of great twists in here that are very well done. And it really opens your eyes to it. But now, you referenced just a second ago, you referenced amnesia, and you did that without saying that was one of your co-written novels with neuropsychologist Donald Davidoff, and that was penned under the that's part of the Peter Zak mystery series, and that's another rich vein of writing that people can access of yours that's available out there. But what led you to the solo writing? How did you move away from the dual writing and get into the solo writing?
Well, we had written 5 novels together, and writing with a partner has its pleasures and its disadvantages. And I think, you know, we both felt it totally enjoyed working together. It was terrific. We had 5 good books, but we weren't setting any, you know, New York Times bestseller bells ringing. So I think we both felt it was time to put that away. And what was scary for me was that the 5 Peter Zak novels were all of them really explored themes in psychology. Amnesia is about memory and whether you can remember something that didn't happen, whether you can forget something that did happen. We were playing with memory, and each of the books in the series, Addiction, Delusion, they all deal with a different aspect of psychology. My co-author is a neuropsychologist at Harvard's McLean Psychiatric Hospital. He evaluates people who are on trial for murder. He was perfect for me to collaborate with. He didn't want to write. I didn't want to make him write. So I got to write, and we got to collaborate on stories. So it was a wonderful partnership. When we stopped working together, I was terrified I wasn't going to have an idea for a novel, that all of the main plots of those Peter Zak novels were really Don's. Mine were usually the subplots. And so I wrote a few nonfiction books and thought, oh, I hope I'm going to get an idea for a book. And eventually I did, but, you know, it was in my world. I got the idea for Never Tell a Lie at a Yard Sale.
That's a great place to take our first break. We're going to break for commercial here and be back in just a minute. Hallie, please hold on. We'll come back and we'll start with Never Tell a Lie.
Okay. Back in the U.S., back in the U.S., back in the U.S. at
all. Oh, and we're back, Prescott. It's a lovely Monday afternoon, and we are honored and privileged to have with us today Hallie Efron, and we have been talking about her newest book, Come and Find Me, and we had just started to talk a little bit about her first book, which was titled Never Tell a Lie, and then that was adapted into a film for the Lifetime Movie Network, and the name of the film is And Baby Will Fall.
Very exciting. Everybody wants to know, how much did I have to do with the screenplay? And of course, the answer is nothing. Sadly, yeah. But I think they did a great job.
Given that your mother and father were famous screenwriters, and by the way, there's kind of a nice symmetry to, they wrote the script for Desk Set, which is a story of computerization and technological change that causes tension, and it's, you know, a classic Hepburn and Tracy movie. There's kind of a nice symmetry there between what they did then and what you're doing in Come and Find Me. But with And Baby Will Fall, even though you didn't get to be a screenwriter for that, the book itself has wonderful reviews. My favorite comment on it was a deliciously creepy tale of obsession. Do you want to talk a little bit about Never Tell a Lie?
Sure. Well, I got the idea for that, not on the internet. I was at a yard sale around the corner from me, and it was at a house that my daughter used to play at, a nice Victorian, looked nice from the outside. The inside was one of these little rabbit warren-y interiors where they had to tear out walls to bring in any kind of light, and that's what the new owners were doing. So I was chatting up the owner in the driveway, asking her, what had they done inside, and peppering her with questions. And finally she looked at me and said, "Would you like to go inside and look around?" And I said, "I'd love to." She pointed at the kitchen door and said, "Help yourself." I went in. No one was there. And there is something intrinsically creepy about being in someone else's empty house. But I wandered around, and sure enough, somewhere around the third floor, the mystery writer in me kicked in, and I thought, what if a woman goes to a yard sale, somehow she talks her way into the house, she goes inside, and she never comes out. And I really freaked myself out. I got out of that house very fast. I was really excited because I had an idea for a book. And it wasn't my co-author's idea. It was my idea. I love yard sales. I could write this. I knew by the time I got home that the woman having the yard sale was 9 months pregnant, and the woman coming to the yard sale was also 9 months pregnant. They knew each other, I thought, from high school. But beyond that, I didn't know anything. I didn't know why the woman came to the yard sale. I didn't know what happened to her. I didn't know anything. And did everything the wrong way, according to my own writing book, and just started writing. And eventually found out what happened to those two characters.
Now, since you made reference to it, you've also written nonfiction, writing and selling your mystery novel, How to Knock 'Em Dead with Style. Yes. And it was nominated for an Edgar Award. So it isn't as if you don't know how to do this, and you've also got the Everything Guide to Writing Your First Novel. So you know from an objective standpoint, from having done the research and put it together, how to do this, but sometimes you have to break the rules. And that's obviously what you had to do with this first book.
I did. Just because you know something doesn't make it easier to do. The one thing I learned early on was that writing a novel is one of the hardest things you can attempt. I mean, it's 300 pages long. It's got to have a particular structure. It's got this three-act structure, and that structure has to be invisible to the reader. It just has to feel right. And it's very, very hard to pull that off, particularly a mystery, a suspense novel, where the ending has to pull together in a very satisfying and surprising way. So it's no mean feat just writing one of these things, never mind writing one well. So I give myself a lot of leeway when I write to write badly. There's a wonderful book, Bird by Bird, by Anne Lamott, and one of her pieces of very good advice for writers is give yourself permission to write a really lousy, she didn't use that word, she used a more profane word, first draft. And I think that's what you have to do in order to get to a decent 25th draft.
Well, I know from personal experience and people who have not faced the loneliness of being the long distance writer, if you're writing a dissertation and you're sitting there staring at the blank screen and you've got, the rule is I must write a page and a half a day so I can be done while I'm still funded for my research.
And that's my rule, a page and a half, exactly that, 500 words.
Yeah, and you got to do her, and if you don't, you're in trouble. And if you can just, the trickiest part of that, in my mind, is that it's just like long distance running. I took up running when I was about 25 years old, and I ran for about 15 years. And the only thing similar to writing is being out in the middle of a marathon and being at 14 or 15 miles and knowing you got another 11 to go. And you just got to keep plodding. You got to just, it doesn't matter how miserable it is. You just got to keep one foot in front of the other.
You just have to keep on going. And then the good thing about writing is you can go back and fix it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas with a marathon, it's over.
Well,
made it or you didn't.
That's right. Your mind is telling you that you'll fix the way you ran this marathon in the next one, which is basically a second draft.
But
that's kind of another
story.
But
it is a kind of torture. It is a kind of masochism to do this kind of thing. Honestly, it is, which is why, you know, one of the things I love to do is meet people who are readers and meet people who are writers. And you meet so many people who say, oh, I've always meant to write a book. I have a great idea and I started it. And you know that, what does that mean? Well, all right, I wrote 10 pages or I wrote 30 pages. But it's very hard to get to the end. Or then you talk to somebody who says, oh, I have a 1,000-page novel. You want to say, I don't think so.
That's
not going to sell.
That's my favorite screen image. I don't even remember the name of the film, but there's a film with Mike Douglas where he's a college professor.
The Wonder Boys. It's great.
Exactly. And
writing is about making choices. What a great movie.
He starts putting in the number, the page number, and it looks like it's going to be 104, and it's 10,412.
Right.
You just go, dear God, edit
movie.
Yourself.
And I use that example a lot when I talk to this problem of making choices, that every word you pick, every image.
Hallie, we've got to take a hard break here at the bottom of the hour for Fox News. We'll be back in about 2-3 minutes, so just hold on, okay? Be right back. Alrighty, folks, we're back, and we have the honor and privilege of visiting today with Hallie Efron, and we're talking about her newest book, which is called Come and Find Me, and we were just discussing Never Tell a Lie, which is her first book. Now, you're also going to be down, you're going to be down in Florida Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at the Lake County Festival, Library Festival of Reading, is that right?
I am. They have a murder, mystery, and mayhem day, and so I'm going to be talking on at 2:00 at the Bland Public Library, T. Bland Public Library in Mount Dora, and then at 7:00 at the City of Lady Lake Public Library, I'll be talking about Come and Find Me.
And then you've got a really full schedule, and anyone who wants to see where you're going to be, if they'll go to your website, HallieEfron.com, they can get the news on new books, they can get events, they can get your biography, press kit, they can get your contact. And you also lead a series of writing seminars. You've got, what's the name of it here? Seascape, Escape to Write.
We do. Anybody who's working on a manuscript and wants to spend a lovely weekend in Connecticut in the fall should... go look at that. We critique manuscript sections for people, and for folks who are in the middle of writing, it's really a very, I want to say, therapeutic and positive experience. We have a good time. I teach it with two other writers, Susan Hubbard and Roberta Islip.
Very good. Now, when you were writing Never Tell a Lie, and you get to the point where you know you've got two women who are 9 months pregnant, and you've had the experience at the yard sale, how do you bring in the husband? How do you flesh that character out? Because from what I can tell, I have not read that book, but from what I can tell in here, he's kind of the fulcrum on that. Whether or not he's trustworthy becomes the fulcrum
of
the story.
He's totally the fulcrum. It's a triangle. I mean, I'm giving it away, but he's the man that both women love. But you don't know that at the beginning. So then whether or not he claims at first that he doesn't know this woman who's come, but he does. So he's the wild card.
Well, it seems that
it's about betrayal. I do find I keep revisiting that as a theme.
Yeah.
How do you know who you can trust?
Well, and that's in the broadest sense, that's the singular question in cyberspace. You know, can I trust the company, the person, the comment that comes from the other side of the screen? And whether it's trusting them with the credit card number to buy things, or whether it's trusting people when you go on Facebook, whatever it is, it's always about trust on the internet. And you know, it's what's the old saying, you know, have faith in God, but tie up your camel. It's pretty hard to have that kind of trust in 2011.
And yet, you know, every day you get an email, another email. You just trust that they're coming from the person that you that signed it. When I researched, that online world, Second Life, it turns out a huge number of female avatars are controlled by men.
Right.
And, you really don't know what you're dealing with.
Absolutely. And it's so interesting because my little college teaches a course on Second World. And I have two friends who are instructors for this course, and they spend the first 2 weeks of the course saying, trust no one. I mean, they say it in 1,000 different ways, and they give all these different examples. But before they really will, give people clues and hints and show them how to set themselves up, it's all about, look, you can't go in here like a child. You can't go in here naive. If you go into this world naive, you're going to be abused, and you don't need to be abused. You can be abused in real life. You don't have to go online to seek it out.
That's the key, you see, is that it really isn't that different from real life. People can fool you in real life as well. But I think on the internet it's even easier. I mean, all of the scams, all the pornography, all of the, deal that's not a deal.
Right.
It's all on the internet.
Well, to me, and again, one of the things that appealed to me about this book so much is one of the debates that we're having and we've been having forever, for the whole time we've taught online, is how do I know that it's actually the person taking the exam at the other end of the line? If I do online testing, how do I validate that it's that person?
Right.
And my answer has always been, well, in the classroom, I'm not asking for IDs. We don't have time to scan an ID. We don't, I don't have time to take a fingerprint. I don't, there's a whole question of security that I just can't raise. And as an instructor, as a person responsible for dissemination of knowledge, at some point I've got to go, I just have to take it on faith that they are who they are. I can't
I think the other thing about learning is that if the person's not really taking the test, they're not really getting the learning from taking the test. I mean, tests exist because they help people learn the material. I mean, it's not just about evaluating people. It's about a feedback mechanism.
Well, and as someone schooled in math, I mean, you remember, and especially Ed Psych, I used to teach the graduate course in tests and measurement, and we would start out with, there's the true test score, and then there's the noise around it that is the, each time you take it, you'll get a score, but then there's your true, the construct knowledge that you actually possess. So there's capital T minus small t equals the error between the two. And, I would spend so much time with the kids on that, and they just go, well, isn't a test just a test? Oh, no, no, no.
Yeah. Well, all they care about is the number they get. And honestly, that's probably all they should. But they should also care about, what did I miss and why did I miss it?
Well,
that's the whole point of learning is the feedback loop.
Well, this is one of the problems with the internet. The internet speeds everything up. So it's all a question of when do I get done? And instead of learning being about dialogue from the Greek dialogos for meaning to pass through, learning becomes about when am I accredited? When do I get the check mark in the box? We got to take another.
And the kids game the system rather than.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're gaming you all the time. It kind of hurts sometimes. Hallie, we got to take another little quick break here and we'll be right back. So please hold on. Back, Preston. It's a beautiful Monday afternoon, and we are visiting with Hallie Efren. And before we get back to Hallie, I just want to mention to you really quickly, don't forget the Qantas auction tonight from 7 to 10 p.m. This is week 2. We need to raise, the target is tens of thousands of dollars. I don't remember right offhand whether it was 20 or 30 or 40. But we're aiming for a bunch of money on that. So either watch live on Channel 13 on Cable 1, or you can go online to PrescottKiwanisAuction.com. But help them out with that because they do a bunch of good things. Now, Hallie, your tour kind of has the big ending with the Festival of Woman Authors Luncheon. Who are some of your favorite female authors? Who are some of your favorite woman authors currently?
Well, I named the character in Come and Find Me after one of them, and that's Patricia Highsmith, who I don't write like her, but I just love reading her. She wrote, of course, like Strangers on a Train and the one about the character who fools everybody. She's a great suspense writer. I love reading her. I just read a new novel by a debut writer for her first novel by Taylor Stevens. It's called The Informationist, and she's got a great female character that reminds me of the Mallory novels. Carol O'Connell is a wonderful woman mystery writer who created a series with a main character she calls her a baby sociopath. She's tall and damaged and incredibly smart and perceptive. And this character in The Informationist comes in that same, it's also like the character in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, even though that's by a man. That's a fabulous woman character. I love the Denise Mina books. There's a lot of wonderful Scottish women mystery writers, very dark. Denise Mina is one of them. Val McDermott is another. You know, they've sort of developed a whole sub-area called Tartan Noir for Scottish mysteries. I think, you know, women have come into their own in terms of mystery writing. Tess Gerritsen, Sue Grafton, of course. There's just a lot of really wonderful women mystery writers out there.
Now, do you think that they're able to translate their novels into movies as easily as male writers are?
Good question. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, what makes, you know, my movie was made into a movie for the Lifetime Movie Network, and they look for women's fiction. And I also think they're looking a little bit for books that will be easy to translate, in that there won't be, you know, problems with going on location in Afghanistan or something.
Right,
you
know, right.
Keeping the costs down. And so I think my book, Never Tell a Lie, was kind of perfect for them because it was a woman's story and it took place in a house and in a hospital. There weren't huge demands on the production itself. So, I mean, on the other hand, I think to make a feature film, I don't think women's crime fiction very often gets made into, I mean, much more often it's the big, like Lincoln Lawyer right now is by the fabulous writer. Michael Connelly's one of the best mystery writers out there, and that was my favorite of his books. But, you know, his books get made into movies. Dennis Lehane's books get made into movies. Robert B. Parker, you know, the big male guns. Laura Lippman, who's one of the really wonderful women writers right now, I don't think any of her books have been made into movies. So I think it's too bad. I don't think women's crime fiction as frequently gets picked up.
Now, is that because of institutional bias against female writers, or is that because they're coming from a different perspective and there's a fear that it won't translate into a mass market, or is it the global sales aspect, or what do you think drives that?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I think part of it is that the books themselves don't hit the big numbers the way the men's books do. I mean, if you just look at the New York Times bestseller list, you know, who's on it, James Patterson, you know, Michael Connelly, Lee Child, it's a lot of the heavy hitters on the male side. And I think their numbers are extraordinary. Their following is huge. So it would be natural to pick up their books and turn them into movies. It's hard to think of women who hit that heavy. Maybe Janet Ivanovich, but she doesn't with her new books so much. I mean, can you think of any women, you know, crime writers that are really hitting it out of the park time after time again in terms of numbers?
Well, I want to see you start hitting it out of the park, starting with, you know, I want to see Coming. I want to see Come and Find Me made into a major movie. This is, yeah. We, you know, our society right now is ripe. Every one of the issues that you cover in this book, each part, whether it's trust, whether it's relationship, whether it's the internet, everything you're doing in this book is so topical and it's so on point. And I can tell you with my students, and I've got a broad cross section of students, exactly what Diana's going through. Many of my students are going through. Holly, we got to take another quick break here. We'll be right back. We're back, Prescott, and we are visiting today with Hallie Efron. And I just want to mention again that if you go to her website, which is hallieefron.com, you can see all of her books. And her books are Come and Find Me is the most recent. That's fiction. Never Tell a Lie. That's fiction. It was made into a movie on Lifetime Network. There are also nonfiction, The Bibliophile's Devotional, 1001 Books for Every Mood, The Everything Guide to Writing Your First Novel, Writing and Selling Your First, or Writing and Selling Your Mystery Novel, How to Knock 'em Dead with Style. And then the Peter Zak novels are Amnesia, Addiction, Delusion, Obsessed, and Guilt. And you can't get, you know, if you're getting ready to stock up the cabin with good reading material for the summer, you couldn't do any better than swooping in and getting in the Zak novels, especially the Dr. Peter Zak novels, Amnesia, Addiction, Delusion, Obsessed, Guilt. Pick those up in paperback, take them to the cabin. You got your summer reading set up. If you want to get hardback, Come and Find Me is excellent. I highly recommend it. And then also Never Tell a Lie, or you can see that as the movie on Lifetime Network, and Baby Will Fall. So, Hallie, we're down here to our last few minutes. What's the new book? What's coming up? What are you working on now?
I'm working on a book that tells the story of a very old woman and a very young woman who live in the Bronx. So I've changed locations. And it's about a house. So I'm back to what my first book was about. My first book was also about a house. But this house is on one of the few remaining marshes, one of the marshes that Robert Moses didn't fill in with a view of Manhattan, the Manhattan skyline. So and I've got a character who's a museum curator. She's working with artifacts from 9/11.
Oh, wow.
So it's an interesting book. Of course, I have no idea happens in the middle. I know exactly what happens in the beginning because I've written it. In that first 100 pages, I know just what's going to happen in the last 100 pages. But I'm struggling now through the mushy middle, which is the hard part.
Now, when you start a book, do you do an outline? Do you do an overlay or a storyboard of the book, or do you just start writing when it hits you and write until it doesn't hit you? How do you go about this from a process level?
I usually get an idea and I just start writing something until I have maybe 20 or 30 pages, and then I sit back and I say, okay, what is this? Is this going to sustain a 300 page book? And I write a synopsis. And a synopsis can be 30 pages long, single-spaced. It's a detailed retelling of the story, kind of like jacket copy. You know how jacket copy tells the story? Well, that's what a synopsis does. And it tells it from beginning to end. And then these days, I don't have to write the whole book in order to get a contract, which is very nice. So if I can write, say, 50 pages of the beginning of the novel and a good detailed synopsis, and the publisher likes it, then I get in the groove and start to write. You know, and exactly what you said. You said a page and a half a day. That's almost exactly my goal. 500 words a day is a page and a half. And if I can do that every day, I've got a novel in 6 months. I've got
a
first draft.
And I remember the famous 60 Minutes story with Louis L'Amour sitting at his desk in the middle of an intersection writing. You know, he said, I can write a page anywhere. And he's sitting there typing away on the old Smith Corona in the middle of the intersection. And I always respected the discipline that the guy had, because he could sit down anywhere and knock out that page at a time. And it is. It's very, very lonely. It's the long distance runner. But if you can get in that habit, then you got her done. Now at this stage where your kids are grown, How does your day go? Do you get up and, you know, the husband takes off to work and you're there in front of the screen, or what's going on?
That's basically it. But it's interesting that you said, you know, sitting in the car typing on the Smith Corona, because I do find a change of venue helps.
Yep.
You know, taking my computer, and it's so nice now that we have laptops.
Uh-huh.
Taking it into the Starbucks or to, I have a wonderful public library. I like to take it where there's no internet.
So you can't get distracted?
You know, it's nice not to, because what happens is you write a paragraph and you check your email. You write a line and you check your email again. You revise the paragraph and you check your email. It's like one of those crazy pigeons that are pecking to get a reward of feed or something.
Right, in the old B.F. Skinner box.
A Skinner box, yeah.
Yeah, you don't.
So it's nice to change venues. It's nice to disconnect from the internet. I try to do that at least a couple of days a week, just to refresh. And often I find the writing is fresher in a different place.
Absolutely. That's the old rule was, where I grew up in Missoula in Great Falls, Montana, we used to always say, you're a different person in Missoula than you are in Great Falls. And we extended that to everywhere else on earth. If you just, you know, you don't like, you want to change your mind, change your location.
Right.
Now, if people want to get coaching from you, you also do writing. You do coaching on writing and how to become a great speaker, and they can contact you through your website.
Well, actually, I mean, I only teach and do manuscript critiques through writing workshops. So, I mean, I'm going to one in Ohio in 2 days called the Mad Anthony Writers Conference, and I'm carrying around with me a bunch of manuscripts from there. You know, people submit pages. And so if anybody looks at my website, you can see the events that I'll be at. And that's the only place I teach or critique manuscripts. I did for a while do whole book critiques, but I just don't have the time for it right now, so I don't do it. But I love to teach at writing conferences, love to meet people working on projects. And, you know, not in Arizona. Do you all have writing conferences in Arizona?
Oh, yeah. We've got my little college has several Southwestern writing conferences that are fairly well attended. We used to have a lot of the environmental authors, Ed Abbey, and a bunch of the guys would come here and teach. And it was always well attended. And you'd fit right in. They'd love to have you here. Hallie, we're almost out of time. I want to tell all our listeners that Come and Find Me is a great novel of suspense. Get it, read it, get the rest of Miss Efron's works, and you'll really like them. And Hallie, it was a pleasure to have you on the show today. I'm so sorry we missed you last week, and I can't wait to have you come back when you get your new book out.
Well, thanks, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye, Prescott. See you tomorrow.